I want to get into, let's explain what you do. You're a digital artist who sells NFTs of your artwork. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I've been making digital art for the last, like, 20 years. Yeah. And sort of growing in sort of popularity over that time. But there was no way to sort of collect my work without the, like, NFT part of it. And so then this technology came along, NFTs, that allow sort of, like, ownership over something virtual. And that allowed people to actually collect what I do, similar to a painting or a sculpture or any other sort of, like, artist. And so things have gotten a little crazy since.
Yeah.
Mike Winkelmann has been creating digital art for over 2 decades. He's 40 years old, lives in South Carolina, and has a degree in computer science from Purdue. But this isn't a show about Mike Winkelmann. Well, not exactly. This is a show about Beeple, the name by which Winkelmann is best known, the name that took the art world by storm in 2021 when an NFT of his nearly 15-year project, Everydays, sold at Christie's for a record $69.3 million. NFT is short for non-fungible token. Let's just say it's a newish and tangible way for people to finally own a piece of art that previously existed only in a digital space. We'll get to that a bit later. After a whirlwind year that changed the course of Beeple's life, and even that's understating it, we wanted to check in with him and see how things are going and learn a bit more about an upcoming and related museum project. Lots to discuss. But before we start, a quick note. Mike's language can sometimes be just as colorful as his art, which is pop culture laden, sometimes surrealist, and sometimes a lot of fun, even a bit tongue-in-cheek. And while I wouldn't call this an especially family-focused podcast, after all, we've talked to John Waters and even hosted an episode called Getting High with Killer Mike. We are a public radio program and did want to pump the brakes a little bit on the F-bombs. But mostly, and please forgive us, we just want to tell you that we will occasionally be beeping Beeple. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential.
What's it kind of like looking back on the last year or so? Have you had a chance to kind of pause and take a breath?
It has been a lot to process. I will definitely say that. I have not gotten that pause to process moment just because we've been working so hard on the next things and sort of, you know, wanting to push forward the sort of dialogue around physical, digital, and sort of ownership and what this sort of new paradigm we're living in means and can be and how it can be better and something that's more empowering for artists and democratizes sort of who can think of themselves as an art collector as well. And so haven't really gotten a chance to fully kind of process where we are now. It's still like,
you're still very much
in the middle of it and crazy keeps happening. So like there's no shortage of, okay, now that happened. It keeps kind of rolling here.
You know, you've been doing your work for a long time now, a couple decades at least. And obviously more people know your work now than ever before, but it's not as if this is an overnight story, overnight success. People do kind of perceive it in a certain way when they hear about someone for the first time. It seems to me, reading about your work and following your work, that you've certainly, for lack of a better term, paid your dues and done the due diligence. But I think there could be some people that might say, hey, this guy just came out of nowhere and took over. Is that something that you care about, that you think about, that you deal with at all?
Well, I think it is. That is a lot of people's sort of impression of me, I think, who just learned of me last year. I get it. But I think what's interesting is, and I think it is something I'm trying to dispel because I want people to sort of recognize how we got here. And that's a big piece of why you didn't know about me and why you suddenly do know about me. And I think that actually has a lot more to do with social media and the different ways that people can now distribute and view art, which I think is going to be a much more, it was already important, but there was no sort of like moment to say, wait a second, there's this other group of artists that's coming up through a completely different sort of like path to sort of like recognition. But I think it's honestly the path that more artists will take moving forward, a similar path to mine, in which you sort of grow, you put out art, a lot of art, and you sort of grow a following online and grow a sort of like community around people who believe in what you're trying to do. And then you're able to sort of like help people to collect that work. And that's kind of what happened. And the thing that changed is there was no way to collect my work in a sort of like meaningfully, natively digital way until there was. And so all of these sort of millions of people who did know about me, suddenly they had a way to collect it. And suddenly I was part of this conversation of capital A art, which has been collectible for this entire time. Now you have this new sort of like category of art that I see just the same as sculpture, photography, and just another sort of like medium that is now part of that conversation. And this is something, you know, which I didn't realize, but I do now, having still not a huge, you know, knowledge of art history, but more of a knowledge of art history, is this is not new. Like, this is photography. I had to go for this. For the first roughly 80 years of photography, it was like, that's not art, it's just photography. And that's exactly kind of where we were at with digital art. It was sort of like, well, digital art isn't art, it's just the stuff in video games and movies and stuff. Like, we've all seen it, we know what it is, kind of, but we're not thinking it in the context of, again, sort of capital A art. And so recognizing that this is something that happens, that art does, it sort of swallows things that were not previously art, and then they get dragged into the conversation. And now it's like, oh, wait, yeah, I guess that could be considered art.
Yeah,
I think that that's something that's happened a bunch of times, and sort of recognizing that moment and that, like, where we are, I think is something that I'm also trying to help people take a longer look at how this does fit into the history of art.
Where did you grow up, and, you know, what kind of exposure did you have to museums and artwork as a kid? Was that a big part of your life growing up?
Zero. So I grew up in a small town in Wisconsin, Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. The town I grew up in is actually North Fond du Lac, which is about 4,000 people. Fond du Lac is 40,000 people. The closest big city is Milwaukee, but it's about an hour and a half away. It's not like a suburb. It's
that's another world, basically.
That's another world. That was, well, you're going down to Milwaukee. That's a big day trip. And so there is an art museum there, and I'd been to it, and I'd actually sort of like performed at it a few times in some sort of functions that they had. But it was always kind of like, oh, we're doing this thing at night. It's kind of, you know, it's this kooky, weird new stuff. And this was actually a long time ago. This was probably 15 years ago. So growing up, art was not a part of, like, my parents, no interest in art. My dad, you know, was an engineer. My mom was a senior center director. That was just not a part of our life at all. But from the time I was, you know, in college, that was like the driving force of my adult life, was like creating art. What can I do to create this stuff? And in my opinion, it was always sort of part of the conversation. It was always like art, capital A art. I didn't see a distinction between lowercase art and capital A art. And so this was definitely realizing that there was such a strong distinction, and that people would look at these pictures that I've, you know, drawn, made, produced, whatever, over the last 20 years and been like, well, that's not art. And said, well, what is it then? It's a picture that I drew. What else would you call it? You're literally just saying that just because it's not like on a piece of paper. And so I was surprised by that. But yeah, art was not really kind of a factor growing up.
So if you mentioned that, you know, by the time you got into college, it really was the focal point, but it was not at all part of your childhood. Where was the spark in between? What was the bridge between, you know, something had to have happened where it took you from zero to, hey, this is my life's pursuit. Where was that moment in between there?
I was always interested in sort of like, you know, producing art as like a kid, drawings and stuff like that. And then when I got to college, I don't know, maybe I just had more time on my hands, and it was sort of like I could I just dove into this sort of mixture of art and design at the time, sort of like communities. And this was in 1999. I had a, you know, internet connection, you know, suddenly, and sort of was being exposed to a lot more things that people were doing all over the world and seeing all this like cool stuff that felt very cutting edge, felt very like, I've not seen this before. And it was just like super inspiring to me. And there was no thought of like having people collect it or sort of making a living directly on selling the art.
It was just expression. It was just pure expression.
It was just expression. It was just like, I'm creating this just to like express myself and hopefully other it resonates with other people. And then over time, I saw that that work, as I started gaining more of a following, was bringing in better sort of freelance work. And I was able to work on more and more like high profile things to where I'm working with Louis Vuitton and I'm doing the Super Bowl and like that. And so I saw the like sort of like, you know, financial benefits from that. But again, it was still through like people seeing the work that I just did that nobody was collecting and nobody sort of like was thinking of it in that terms. And then sort of hiring me to do spec work, custom work for them.
In the art world, we put everybody in silos. So, you know, when you're doing work like that, it's like, whoa, you're in the commercial art silo or you're in the graphic design silo and the fine art silo is over here. You can never go from over here to over here. And one of the cool things I think that's happening with what you're doing is that we're starting to blend all those things finally and break down the, I think for the most part, unneeded barriers between all of those things, you know? And we're about the same age. I'm 41.
I'm 40.
And, you know, when I was a kid, of course, digital art really wasn't, you know, of course, Pixar maybe was doing things in the 80s. But in our world, it was still drawing on pieces of paper or doing whatever. It wasn't there. And now, you know, being, you know, in our 40s and you're this kind of, in some ways, seen as this kind of wunderkind new person doing something groundbreaking. I always thought the people who are in the world you're in now probably see you as kind of like grandpa compared to some kids. They probably thought the NFT person who was going to break out in NFT would be like 19. You know what I mean? Like the 20-year-old.
100%.
Everyone thinks of these things as the dominion of the young, right? And it's like, you know, you've been in this world and kind of certainly you didn't plan on it. You didn't know what an NFT was, but you kept following that path. Talk about persistence. Because one of the things I love about your work is it's just, you just have kept doing it. Didn't matter if you were getting paid for it or anything else. You just do it.
100%. And I think that's what was also, to be honest, quite humorous to me when people are like, this is just all about money. And this, you know, this is all this financial thing. And it's like, guys, I started doing this before the blockchain existed. I did this for free for 20 years. Show me a painter who just kept putting out paintings for 20 years and nobody bought a single one. That's not a thing. Come on, guys. And so, yeah, this was never about money.
You know, Van Gogh, maybe. He didn't sell
maybe Van Gogh, but even he was trying to sell the paintings.
Obviously, it was frustrating to him.
Yeah. It's one of these things where the financial component, which to be quite honest, I feel very lucky having sort of been able to do work for 20 years and have that be no part of my thought process. No part of like, is somebody going to buy this? Is this something they're going to like to have on their wall? It was like, I don't need to think about any of that because nobody's going to have it on their wall. Nobody's going to collect it. I could just say exactly what I want to say without any sort of like financial consideration. And then I also feel very lucky that I made a shitload of money in like one fell swoop. So it's like, well, now I'm really not going to do anything for money because I've got enough money to just say exactly what I want to say.
Yeah. So you find a freedom in that, you know, by having gone through this past year, even if you never sell another piece of work, it's changed everything in terms of, but in some ways it didn't change. It just allowed you to keep doing what you were doing before, right?
It does. And it allows me to do it at a sort of like higher level on things that it would be like, you know, sort of a pipe dream before where it's like, okay, well, I'd love to do this thing, but just making that sculpture is going to cost $1 million. And sort of, well, I can't do that. I don't have $1 million. And so it's allowed me to sort of like do this to a much bigger extreme that I just, you know, before had kind of like dreamed of, but now I'm able to sort of execute on that. And I feel very lucky and I feel like now I have more sort of like confidence as an artist to recognize the decisions that could be made for pure financial gain and sort of like, no, I'm going to do this like the way I want. And if people don't want to buy it or it's not, you know, I'm not out to just make decoration for billionaires or whatever. Yeah. Like I want to make something that feels like it's pushing the conversation of what art is and what art could be forward. Because to me, those are the, in the albeit brief and limited knowledge of art history that I have, those are the names that stick around. The people who did something different where it's like, whoa. And at first there was a backlash and there was a bunch of people who were like, that's not art. You can't draw like that. You can't paint paintings like that. And then they settled down for a second. They're like, yeah, I guess you can. Jackson Pollock painting like that. It was like, that's not painting. You didn't do it how you should have. And then it was like, oh yeah, I guess that could be an interesting. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to push just 1 millimeter forward our definition of what art can be.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by QR codes. That's right, folks, they're back and more popular than ever, a second coming on par with John Travolta's Pulp Fiction era renaissance, or perhaps when Meatloaf burst back onto the scene with that hit single, I Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That. Sure, the reason is a global pandemic and people not wanting to really touch things anymore, but that's not the fault of QR codes. They've always been here, even when you thought they were over with, waiting for a second act. This, it would seem, is that second act, and they're not going anywhere.
So the piece that really kind of broke you out last year and was the, you know, kind of record-breaking sale was not really a piece. It was tons of pieces, and this was from a project you've been doing, these everyday series, which you started in, what, 2005?
2007. Just to kind of back up for one second, I do actually consider that one piece because it's one very specific project that has very defined rules. It has a very defined start date. And it's not something, I think people don't understand the like sort of like rules and kind of that isn't just like me ripping a bunch of pages out of my sketchbook or me going through a bunch of like hard drives and like, oh, okay, here's all this stuff in one picture.
This is not like Bruce Springsteen selling his song catalog to...
This isn't like great Beatles' greatest hits over the last 20 years. No, this was one project, which is just one of the projects that I've sort of done over those times. I've also made a lot of short films. I have these VJ clips that people don't really know about yet that were these free Creative Commons clips that are became super, super popular. But like that was one very defined thing where I do a picture that day, every single day, and post it somewhere by midnight. And I don't do two pictures in one day. I don't do, you know, four pictures and then just release them. It's on that day I do a picture. And it's a project to me that it had this sort of like milestone and was able to produce this image. But I do view that image as one.
So you do it as a collage. It's a collage of sorts.
It is a collage, but it's one single image that took me 13 years to make.
Did you ever miss a day?
No, I did not. And that's something that I'm like very, even I'm kind of surprised of, but no, I have not missed a day in that time. And so again, it's very much like I take the rules of that and getting it done each day. Today, in the next 10 hours, I will have to do a picture. The day of the sale, I had to do a picture right away. And so it is something that I would like people to look at as a singular sort of like project versus just like me scooping together a bunch of
That's a good clarification. I know you had this project that you've talked about wanting to do this kind of digital art museum. I think one of the problems people have generally with digital art is just the fact that they can't understand the non-tangible element of it. You know, if it's digital, just print me off a copy. That's kind of what they say. And they say, well, that's not really what it is. So how do you see this working? What would a digital museum be like? Is it a website that I go to? Is it a How would I experience and engage with a space like that?
Yeah, so we are actually building that right now. We just actually broke ground on it earlier this week. It should be done by like mid-June. And so it's here in Charleston. We've got like a 50,000 square foot building that we're leasing. We'll serve a few different purposes. one, it's going to be, it's our studio. It's where we actually sort of like make the work. And I've got like a bunch of engineers and artists and stuff there. The other thing is, another piece of it is a 13,000 square foot sort of like white wall gallery. And that's going to be, eventually, I think I could see it sort of transitioning to a museum. But at first, it's going to just showcase like all of the work that I've done over the last 20 years. It's sort of like a little kind of like mid-career retrospective type thing. So people can kind of come in and see all the shit that is like, oh, I've been doing this for 20 years. It's like, okay, cool.
Will all the everyday pieces be part of that?
So there will be one very giant, massive everyday's work. But then there's also, again, the short films that I've done, the VJ clips, there's like 250 of those too. It will show those and kind of explain what those are too, because I think, again, that was something where I was entering a bunch of film festivals and I was getting rejected to them because, again, it was sort of like, what the f*** is this? Like, is this DVD skipping? Like, what the hell? And so I realized that I want to get my work out there. It's not something where it's like, oh, you make a painting and you sort of, then you just give it to other people to kind of like paint on top of it. And so explaining those and having it be a place where I don't have to sort of like wait for a museum show or wait for a gallery show. I can sort of bring in my collectors too with the NFTs. They can kind of serve as sort of like tickets to this sort of gallery and sort of bring people in to educate them around how this stuff is made and, you know, the history of sort of like digital art over the last 20 years. Then the other thing that the space will have is more of a sort of, for lack of a better term, sort of forward thinking museum that will be more akin to these like Superblue or Team Lab or these sort of Van Gogh immersive experiences where there's a bunch of projectors you're projecting all over. That is something that I think will be more akin to the sort of like museum experience in the future, in that it's something more visceral and something that feels more engaging and more sort of like interactive. And so it will have a space dedicated to that as well. So really trying to kind of make a place that feels like kind of the sort of like studio of the future. In terms of your question with, you know, people printing these things out or this or that, I'm totally fine with that. And there are some of the everydays I'm getting made into giant paintings and sort of like all different things. And I kind of look at that as sort of like the digital version in some ways is almost like the pure idea without like the encumbrances of sort of like physical form. And I think that idea can sort of manifest itself in a number of different ways, from a giant painting of that exact image to a print to viewing it on your screen. And I think each kind of have their own pluses and minuses. Obviously, if you have a giant physical sort of manifestation of a digital image, then you have to move it around if you want to like show people. But the digital thing, you can view it anywhere, but you're viewing it on, you know, a tiny screen and it doesn't really look that cool. So to me, I'm not super precious about like, well, what medium is that? What is blah, blah, blah? Like, to me, I'm more interested in what are the ideas that this image is trying to get across? And then what ways can you sort of have this blending between the two worlds, because that's what I think the future is. I don't think it's going to be, and this is in sort of like all aspects of society, I don't think it's going to be like digital or physical. I think the digital world, the physical world are just going to meld. And you're seeing that happen now in art. And I don't see how that trend is not going to continue.
Just to wrap up, I'm curious, not just your financial situation has changed, but just your being known has changed, but also you have this moniker, right? People know you as Beeple, but your Mike, that's your actual name. Is it going to be helpful, do you think, to have this kind of moniker that keeps a barrier between you and the rest of the world? Do you want people to know you kind of through this Banksy-esque kind of way, or do you want to put your name out there in the public more as it is? I'm just curious how you see that as a help or a hurt.
I honestly don't see a massive sort of distinction between Beeple and me. The reason that sort of like came about is, again, in the early sort of 2000s, the people who were huge influences on me were people like designers who kind of like took online names, because again, my entire kind of practice has been very much online. And that's another sort of distinction that I think when people are like, well, digital art's been around since, you know, the 60s with Bell Labs and blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, that's quite different than somebody like myself who would make a piece of art and then post it on social media and immediately, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of people can view it. That's new. That's not something that we've ever sort of like seen in history. That level of sort of like immediate access and immediate feedback with the public. And so I feel like the internet in general is a big piece of sort of like who I am. And at the time when I was sort of starting to make work under the name Beeple, it was very popular to kind of like take a pseudonym or something like that. But people know I'm not trying to hide my real name, and people know me, and some people call me Beeple and some people call me Mike. And it's not like a persona. It's really like, that's just, it's shorthand. My name's super long and wonky. And so it's just easier to just say Beeple than.
The first exhibition of computer-generated art in the United States opened in April 1965 at the Howard Wise Gallery in New York City. The show featured works by A. Michael Knoll and Bela Ulish, an engineer and neuroscientist respectively. It was simply titled, Computer-Generated Pictures. None of the art sold, and there was little, if any, press coverage. Well, that's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. Additional production assistance from Jack Dean. Theme music by Broncho. For more on the museum and the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. As always, we suggest both. Until next time, look closer.